Wednesday, November 20, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. When most families have a dispute, the conflict does not bleed over into the headlines of the nation's leading newspapers. But then most families are not the Cheney family. In particular, the family of former United States Vice President Dick Cheney and his wife Lynn. The couple has two daughters. Liz, the older of the daughters, is running for the Republican nomination for the United States Senate in Wyoming, running against, we might note, an incumbent Republican senator. The younger daughter, Mary, is married to her same-sex partner named Heather, and they live with their children. That set up the dynamic for the conflict that erupted into the public on Sunday. As the New York Times reporter Jonathan Martin tells us, the dispute happened as a feud between the two spilled into public view involving social media, an angry same-sex spouse, a high-profile election, and a father who feels uncomfortably caught between his two children. The situation has deteriorated so much that the two sisters have not spoken since the summer, and the whole fuss threatens to get in the way of something former Vice President Dick Cheney and his wife Lynn desperately want, and that is a United States Senate seat for Liz. As Martin reports, it all began on Sunday, or at least the public dispute erupted on Sunday, when Liz Cheney appeared on Fox News Sunday, a program watched by Mary Cheney and the woman identified as her wife. As Martin reports, in Liz Cheney's appearance on the program, she said that she does not believe in or support legalized same-sex marriage, describing it as, quote, just an area where we disagree, end quote, explicitly referring to her own sister. Martin then writes that Mary Cheney was taken aback and she went to her Facebook page to write, quote, Liz, this isn't just an issue on which we disagree. You're just wrong and on the wrong side of history, end quote. Heather Poe, again identified as Mary Cheney's wife, then also went to Facebook writing, quote, I can't help but wonder how Liz would feel if, as she moved from state to state, she discovered that her family was protected in one but not the other. She then concluded, yes, Liz, in 15 states and the District of Columbia, you are my sister-in-law, end quote. When it comes to the issue of same-sex marriage, certainly to the public discussion of same-sex marriage, the Cheney family as a whole has been supportive of the idea of same-sex unions. As a matter of fact, the former vice president, when he was vice president, wrote publicly with President George W. Bush when President Bush proposed a constitutional amendment to prevent same-sex marriage. Speaking of his own openly lesbian daughter, the vice president said at the time that he believed that same-sex couples should be able to unite in something like civil unions, and eventually he also came to support legalized same-sex marriage. In 2011, he told Barbara Walters, quote, I certainly don't have any problem with same-sex marriage. Liz Cheney, now running for the United States Senate nomination on the Republican side in Wyoming, has been forced to deal with the issue in the context of that electoral contest. The people of Wyoming are very conservative on the issue, certainly Republican voters there are, and Liz Cheney has been required by this political circumstance to make clear her position on same-sex marriage. Many observers have expressed surprise at Liz Cheney's opposition to same-sex marriage now, since she had previously been understood to be supportive. Appearing on MSNBC in the year 2009, when she was interviewed about gay marriage, she said, quote, freedom means freedom for everybody, end quote. In a very bizarre insertion into this debate, the former vice president and his wife have made very clear that they support Liz Cheney in this conflict between the two sisters. They said that it should be understood that Liz has always opposed same-sex marriage, something that seemed to surprise her sister, as well as others in the state of Wyoming and beyond. In an interview with the New York Times on Sunday, Mary Cheney expressed shock at her sister's position, saying that she had presumed that her sister shared her parents' views on same-sex marriage and that Liz had been, quote, always very supportive, end quote, of her relationship with her same-sex partner and now spouse. When the former vice president and his wife released a statement on Monday supporting Liz Cheney and not her sister, Mary Cheney was offended. When the parents suggested that the two sisters would simply have to disagree on the issue, Mary Cheney went back to her Facebook page, writing to her sister, quote, this isn't like a disagreement over grazing fees or what to do about Iran. There isn't a lot of gray here. Either you think all families should be treated equally or you don't. Liz's position is to treat my family as second-class citizens. She then rejected her parents' proposal that she be, quote, lovingly tolerant, end quote, towards her sister's position. The conflict between the two sisters, and between the two sisters and their parents, is something that the family certainly did not want to be announced on the nation's front pages. But it has been announced, and it is now unavoidable. And one thing we need to recognize is that the former vice president bears a good deal of responsibility for making it so. When he was vice president of the United States, Dick Cheney announced that his position on same-sex marriage had changed because he has a lesbian daughter who wanted to marry her lesbian partner. That shift in Dick Cheney's moral position, or at least his political position on same-sex marriage, was later paralleled by other Republican figures who made a very similar shift. In almost every case, they did so because they cited a relative, often one of their own children, in terms of sexual orientation, and thus their perceived need to shift a position. As I explained back when Vice President Cheney made the announcement of his shift on the issue, this amounts to what should be considered and called Republican moral relativism. It isn't the kind of moral relativism of which we are accustomed. That's the form of argument in which it is asserted that there is no absolute morality. Rather, this form of moral relativism has to do with relatives. Republicans and others who now argue that the position on same-sex marriage or some other position related to sexual morality must change or be modified because of the sexual orientation of one of their own relatives. Thus, a new form of moral relativism. As we consider the awkwardness of this argument now amongst the Cheney family, we need to recognize that others are tempted to make the same argument, or soon will be in the future. It's good to be instructed by this embarrassing situation in the Cheney family to recognize that moral relativism simply doesn't work, whether it's the old-fashioned ideological kind or the new kind of relational model that now has put the Cheney family in a rather embarrassing situation. Meanwhile, also in the issue of same-sex marriage, and also related to this new model of moral relativism, a church trial in the state of Pennsylvania on Monday ended up with a Methodist minister, a United Methodist minister, found guilty of having violated the discipline of the church in conducting a same-sex marriage ceremony for his own son. As Michelle Borstein of the Washington Post reports, after weeks of cross-examination, witness lists, and wrangling over admissible evidence, the Reverend Frank Schaefer stood in the gymnasium of a rural Methodist retreat center Monday to answer a charge. Did he violate his faith when he officiated at his son's same-sex wedding? As Borstein reports, by the end of the day, the rare jury of 13 Methodist pastors had found Schaefer guilty on two charges, quote, conducting a ceremony that celebrates same-sex unions, end quote, and disobedience to order and discipline of the Methodist Church. The Associated Press reported on the story, saying that Pastor Schaefer of Lebanon, Pennsylvania, said he could have avoided the trial by agreeing to avoid to do any more same-sex ceremonies, but he declined to make this assurance, noting that three of his four children are gay. The Associated Press went on to explain that the nation's largest mainline Protestant denomination, that is the United Methodist Church, accepts gay and lesbian members but rejects the practice of homosexuality as, quote, incompatible with Christian teaching, end quote. Furthermore, the ordained clergy of the United Methodist Church are expressly forbidden from conducting same-sex ceremonies, weddings or otherwise. As the Washington Post explains, Schaefer is the first among five Methodist ministers to be accused by church officials over just the last year of possibly violating church doctrine on gay rights. The other four could also face church trials. The cases, which are being closely watched by advocates on both sides, represent perhaps the biggest flare-up in recent years in mainline Protestantism over the issue of homosexuality. At 8.3 million members, Methodists are the second largest group of Protestants in the United States, end quote. Well, the largest group of Protestants in the United States, by this definition, would be the churches of the Southern Baptist Convention. But the United Methodist Church is rightly described as the largest of the mainline Protestant denominations. The denominations of the old Protestant mainline, now often referred to as well as liberal Protestantism. But the United Methodist Church is really of a divided mind on the issue of homosexuality, and perhaps also of homosexual marriage, or same-sex marriage. The United Methodist Church clearly does hold and teach that homosexuality is incompatible with Christian or biblical teaching. But at the same time, it seeks to be inclusive in terms of its membership, far more than in terms of its ordained clergy. This puts the church in a rather difficult position, and it is clear that within the church there are those who will not stand for same-sex marriage, and there are those who will not stand for a church that does not endorse and allow same-sex marriage. The denomination is set for a collision course with itself over this issue. Perhaps the most interesting portion of the Washington Post article in this situation is this paragraph, quote, "But in a nation where places of worship seem increasingly to line up on one side or the other on hot-button issues, something else seemed to be on trial, the possibility of a spiritual middle ground," end quote. Later in the article, Borstein explains, "The United Methodist Church, like the rest of mainline Protestantism, has been wrestling with issues surrounding gay rights for decades. It has added affirmations about the dignity of gays and lesbians and the importance of pastors to minister to them. But unlike some other mainline denominations, the Methodist Church has not expanded gay rights on things such as marriage and allowing clergy to be openly gay. In reality," explains the paper, "many Methodist bishops express what can only be described as a don't ask, don't tell policy and operate by that." The paper then reports straightforwardly, "many United Methodist churches are led by gay clergy." It's very interesting that the Washington Post seems concerned that the situation in terms of this trial in the United Methodist Church indicates that a, quote, middle ground, end quote, is disappearing. That's a really interesting argument. We have to step back and ask the question, what would a middle ground on this issue be? Would it be to accept some churches within the denomination practicing same-sex unions and others not? Would it allow a local option? What exactly could a middle ground on this position be? In reality, there isn't a middle ground on this issue. Either a denomination or a church will support same-sex marriage or it will not. It will either allow same-sex ceremonies or it will not. The option to allow it or not to allow it is actually the option to recognize same-sex marriage, which means it's really not a local option on the matter at all. The local option would only be whether to actually conduct the ceremonies. The reality is that no church or denomination can avoid giving a straightforward answer to the question, do you or do you not believe in and support same-sex marriage? Will you or will you not allow the conducting of same-sex marriage ceremonies? On that question, there really is no middle ground. The United Methodist Church is facing that reality in a very public way, but so also is the Cheney family. You put these two stories together and confront then a very important modern dilemma. No church, no denomination, and eventually no family will be able to escape having a very clear and well-understood conviction on this issue. Those committed to the Christian worldview, to the Christian truth claim, and to the authority of Scripture have no option but to stand where Scripture clearly would require us to stand. The Bible simply does not allow for moral relativism, either the old kind or the new. As it turns out, human beings, even as they may attempt to do otherwise, are constantly making moral judgments. An example of this came last week in a Boston courtroom when James, known as Whitey Bulger, Boston's most notorious gangster, was condemned to spend the rest of his life in prison. As Catherine Seeley of the New York Times reports, he received 2 life sentences plus 5 years. As Seeley reports, before announcing her sentence, Judge Denise J. Casper, the Federal District Court, told Whitey Bulger, age 84, that the, quote, scope, callousness, and depravity of your crimes are almost unfathomable, end quote. That's not an exaggeration. Whitey Bulger was convicted back in August of a sweeping array of crimes, including 11 murders and 31 counts of racketeering, extortion, money laundering, trafficking in cocaine, and marijuana and weapons possession. In a very interesting statement, the judge then turned to Whitey Bulger and said that his actions were made, quote, all the more heinous because they were all about money, end quote. As she continued, quote, it takes no business acumen to take money from people the end of a gun, end quote. The interesting aspect of that statement is the raising of the issue, what might have made those crimes less heinous, what other motivation may have reduced the depravity. The judge, nonetheless, was making a very important point. And you'll notice that she used a very interesting word. Referring to Whitey Bulger's crimes, she referred to their scope, callousness, and depravity. That word depravity is a very interesting word to appear in the judge's statement. The word depravity is actually rooted in a deep theological meaning. Depravity has to do with the explanation of why human beings are sinful, of the specific form that our sinfulness takes. Depravity makes a very clear statement of the fact that this is evil, and an evil that doesn't come from without, something that afflicts us, is rather something that comes from within. This news item is about a very important, indeed newsworthy, moral judgment. But this moral judgment isn't an explicitly theological judgment. Not at all. It's a judgment that was made by a secular judge in a secular court against a defendant that was found guilty of multiple and felonious secular crimes. But there's no way to keep this issue secular in terms of the frame of reference. The use of the word depravity actually points to the inherent limits of the secular worldview in coming to terms with the question of why people do such horrible things. In this case, horrible things including at least 11 murders. Actually, Whitey Bulger is suspected of committing many more murders than this, and he still may face trial in state courts in other states for what could be murders leading to capital punishment. But there's another interesting aspect here, isn't there? After all, Whitey Bulger wasn't convicted of these crimes and then given one life sentence. Instead, he was given two life sentences. And on top of those two life sentences, an additional 5 years. He will spend the rest of his life in prison. He's now 84 years of age. But what kind of moral sense or judicial sense does it make to sentence an 84-year-old man, or any human being for that matter, to two life sentences, or even to one life sentence, with any additional years tacked on? It's because a very clear moral statement is being made, a legal statement as well, to be sure. But the moral statement is this: for certain crimes, serving just one life sentence simply isn't enough. It simply won't do. Even though there is no inherent rationality to a second life sentence, at least the judge in this case felt like she was saying something of significance. One life sentence simply isn't enough. Indeed, two life sentences are not enough. On top of this, an additional 5 years. Since he is age 84, Whitey Bulger may never face trial in the other states for the charges of murder that he should face. And he may never face the death penalty, even if found guilty of those murders. But the reality is this, and we know it. Whitey Bulger will not escape the most important judgment of all, and that is the judgment of God. Nor will we escape that judgment unless we are safe in Christ and in the atonement he accomplished for us by the will of the Father. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Baltimore, Maryland, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.